Members, I'm going to call the House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Policy and Finance to order. Today, we've got two bills, one that we're looking to lay over, and then another one that we're looking for a re-referral to the Judiciary Committee. And of course, we want to adopt our minutes. I also just want to very quickly share, and Chair Considine is here, and I suspect, and Representative Christensen is here as well. We'll come back to this, but I just want to acknowledge for the record that the three of us spent darn near 4 hours over at Stillwater Prison.
Four and a half, but who's counting?
Last night. And I think there's a lot to share. We've got actually a good, healthy conversation we need to have here today, so we're not going to be able to do that today. But I hope to have an opportunity to do that. I think there's some important lessons that we picked up that we think we think it's important to share with our colleagues here on the committee. I just want to do a quick nod to the men and women who staff our corrections facility. They do pretty amazing work, and right now in that particular facility, it's very painful work. And I also want to acknowledge the integrity and nobility of the residents who are serving their time there that we met with. We met with, about a dozen or so, maybe more, residents. And there's pain in that community as well. So with that, I'm going to call on Representative Nash for approval of the minutes, because I think Representative Nash wants to share some vitally important information.
Yes. First, we'll get business out of the way, Mr. Chair. I'd move the minutes from both February 12th and 13th and point out that you've decided to join the neckwear crowd today. It must be Valentine's Day, red tie, so thought that would be immortalized perhaps by the house photographer, who I did see is here. Might be good for posterity's sake, but I would move the minutes of both the 12th and the 13th.
Thank you, Representative Nash, and thank you for the acknowledgement. We'll strike all that from the record officially. with that, we do have a motion for approval, and I believe we have two sets of minutes. Is that correct? So these would be minutes of February 13th and February 12th. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nash. And with that, I'm going to call Representative Herdos to – Representative Johnson, please.
Chair Mariani, members, yesterday an email went out to the members of the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee that it's planning on evening meetings the next two Wednesdays. And for some reason, I don't know if it's a glitch in our system or not, but I did not receive that email. But I did pick up on it on a chain with one of the responses from a member. And I was wondering if the chair could explain the reason for evening meetings so early in the session. We have over 5 weeks left before first deadline. And since you are planning to have those evening meetings, if you give the committee and the public an idea of what you're planning to hear, and that would cause us to have evening meetings this early in the legislative session.
Representative Johnson, thank you for your question, and my apologies for you not receiving notice of that. We'll look into why that would have occurred. It's certainly my intention to make sure that everyone knows when we meet. Quite simply, we have a lot of bills that are referred to us. And as we've all done our due diligence just in the last week or two, we spent a good amount of time in a number of individual bills, and appropriately so. And so, quite frankly, what the chair is trying to do is to carve out the space. We can always not have those meetings if we move expeditiously during our regular time. A lot of that's going to be dictated by us, by how much, we are, what kind of questions we're going to ask, how much we want to dig into. I do not want to impede that at all. So my goal is that in the following week, for instance, we'll be hearing a number of driving driving bills. Wednesday, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 that are teed up. If we can get through those in our regular time, then we'll do that, and we won't have the evening meeting. I'm thinking that we might not, and so I'm just carving out that space for us. My hope, members, is that we can minimize the amount of evening meetings so that we're not doing, you know, 3 every week from here on out. And frankly, to the degree that we can be really effective, not effective, but efficient, always want to be effective, but efficient early on, then once we get into that crunch part, for those of you who, this is your first term, there are several crunch periods of time. And as we near those policy deadlines, we're all going to feel intense pressure, most likely running from committee to committee. In order to meet the deadline. So my hope is that if we can invest a little bit up front with a few evening meetings, that we can lessen that crunch for us as we approach the deadline time. So I thank you for the question. I think it's important that members know what the chair is thinking about and that the public is aware of how we're approaching our work. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I want to thank you for the explanation, but since we're starting to get things scheduled, could you give the committee members and also the public an idea of when the next week's schedule will be available?
I'm told by staff it'll be available tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, Representative Hertas, House File 981, and Representative Hertas, I'll move that your bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety and Criminal Justice Policy and Finance Omnibus Bill. And Representative Hertas, we have an amendment that I believe is, well, I know is a delete all amendment. And I'm wondering, I see Representative Long at the table with you. I'm wondering if perhaps, as a member of the committee, Representative Long, if you would be so kind as to move the A190030 delete all amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move House File 981 and then. That it be laid over for consideration as your instruction, and then also move the A19 amendment. This I had a separate bill, House File 982. This bill conforms the two pieces of legislation, and so brings them together for this committee.
Very well. Representative Long moves the A190030 amendment to House File 981, puts the bill in the shape that the author wishes to have it before us today. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Hertas, your bill is before us as amended.
Well, thank you,
Welcome
Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. It's, I guess, 3 years since I've served on public safety, or beginning my third year, but welcome, members, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about House File 981. I'm also pleased to have Representative Long join me in this cause. It's an issue that I've been working on for a number of years, and happy to see that it's getting a hearing once again. Members, traditionally, when offenders offend and they're adjudicated, they're sentenced either to fines, probation, jail, or prison. And when this punishment is complete, oftentimes they think that their debt to society has been paid. And they find out, however, oftentimes after the fact, that they learn that their sentences not only were over, but other problems have begun, and they begin to suffer the consequences of what are referred to as collateral consequences. So to try to give you a little bit of context about how big of a problem this is, and it's continuing to grow, in Minnesota, we rank 47th in the nation with regard to our incarceration rate. On the other hand, Minnesota ranks 6th in the nation with regard to the number of people on direct correctional supervision. That said, that means roughly 4% today of all Minnesota adults are under the supervision of the Department of Corrections. With 80% of those folks that are at least felons and incarcerated, the incarceration cost is about $32,000 a year. I'd like you to consider this. The next time that you might be attending a concert, a wedding, or even a baseball game, I'd ask you to look around you and know that the people surrounding you, that one in 24 persons as adults, is under direct correctional supervision. It's further exacerbated by the problem that we have 87 county prosecutors and hundreds of city prosecutors, all applying different standards and great latitude in terms of the charges that they may bring against an individual with respect to the crime that they've committed. So there's really not a lot of continuity across the state in terms of where you commit the crime and necessarily what type of circumstance you may find yourself in terms of the charges and as well as the ability to negotiate, if you will, the terms of what that conviction might be. And oftentimes, because of the myriad and the caseload of all of these different jurisdictions, what you will find is oftentimes overburdened prosecutors who are most willing to offer what are called stays of adjudication in lieu of actually going to prison. And so many people look at this situation with their own personal circumstances, knowing full well that they've committed a crime, but they also have a mortgage to pay or rent to pay. They might have dependents, and oftentimes willing to quickly move towards these stays of adjudication and avoid or minimize the amount of time that they're going to be, for lack of better terms, out of circulation. So with that in mind, what then happens is the collateral consequences with the rest of what we see going on in our regulatory state and the rules with regards to licensing. 34% of all jobs and occupations require a license today in order to go to work. And oftentimes we make mistakes. People make mistakes and they find that because of the crime they may have done, they no longer are eligible to hold that license and go to work, even though they weren't violent offenders. Maybe situations of public trust. It might be a registered nurse. It could be a nurse anesthetist. It could be a realtor. Could be a building contractor. Any of these people that have a skill in a trade are now denied from being able to work. And so what the collateral consequences bill seeks to do is it requires notice to a person that collateral consequences may apply to them if they plead guilty or if they're convicted of a crime, and also about the information on where to find them. It requires the state to compile a handy list of collateral consequences that can be asked for at any time during the trial and at any time thereafter to enable a person to better understand what forms of relief might be available to them. So it offers two forms of relief. It has an order from the court for limited relief for specific collateral consequences that can be asked for at any time during the trial or at any time thereafter, enabling a person to obtain employment, education, access to housing, an occupational license, and or public benefits. And with that, I think I'd like to share some of this presentation with Representative Long and let him say a little bit more about it.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a real pleasure to be working with Representative Hertas on this bill, and I know he's been leading on this issue for some time, so proud to be up here with Representative Hertas. I'll be brief. I think Representative Hertas did a great job summarizing the issue around collateral consequences. We know that collateral consequences are often a hurdle for folks to be able to reintegrate, and we know that one of our main goals of our criminal justice system is to facilitate successful reentry into society. I want to just give a little bit of the scope of the problem in Minnesota. There are a significant number of laws and rules that restrict activity based on criminal history. The National Inventory of Collateral Consequences of Conviction, which is compiled by the federal government, lists 563 total collateral consequences for Minnesota. They sort those into 17 categories, from impacts on housing to education to employment to licensure. And I'll just pick a few. Any controlled substance offense means you can't drive a limousine and you may not be able to be a family therapist. For a crime of moral turpitude, you may not be able to be an interior designer. For a felony, you may not be able to register as an athlete's agent. For any misdemeanor, you may not be able to be a court interpreter, in addition to some of the impacts on public housing, on school benefits, and the like. Some collateral consequences make a lot of sense, and this bill doesn't do anything to remove a collateral consequence, but some make little sense, particularly in applied to particular circumstances. Representative Hertas laid out the notice requirements. The other piece I'll just highlight is the bill includes an order of limited relief, which authorizes petitions for relief from collateral consequences related to employment, education, housing, public benefits, or occupational licensing. And a court may grant that order at or before sentencing. So this allows for collateral consequences to be a part of plea and sentencing discussions. Courts have discretion to grant this relief if it is needed to live a law-abiding life and if it does not pose an unreasonable risk to public safety. So this would provide a new tool that would allow for conversations about which collateral consequences may or may not make sense in a particular circumstance. That concludes the remarks I'd like to share.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And I want to make it emphatically clear that we're not talking about people who commit crimes as being the victim in this situation in terms of how we adjudicate things. But what I am trying to say and what this bill seeks to do is to reintegrate these people back into mainstream society and make them as productive as possible. We must recognize that 95% of all the people that are incarcerated are released back into society. So the sooner that we can enfranchise them back into the system, make them productive, make them taxpayers, and will actually cause, I believe, less government and also give them a sense of belonging. And if we have some sense of compassion and believe in second chances, we need to try to reintegrate these people as quickly as possible. So I think this is a tool that is long overdue, and we certainly have the regulatory state making rules all the time, and we need to make sure that every individual that enters the courtroom knows that if they're being offered a stay of adjudication, there are collateral consequences that come with it. And oftentimes, I honestly believe that sometimes people would be better off not taking that stay and going through the prosecution and seeing how the chips fall, or maybe even getting 90 days or even a year in jail and then be done with it, be over with it. But they really need to be fully informed about what the consequences are. Thank you, members.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Hertas and Representative Long. I think this is a really important bill, and I think it reflects the values that I've heard from members on both sides, quite frankly, of the aisle in this committee and members who were on this committee that acted last year. Strong messages of hope, the whole notion of not throwing away human beings, not having one act define who they are in their totality for the rest of their lives, even as we hold them accountable for their actions. And consistent with the theme of community-centered public safety, which looks at how the decisions here impact our community life and either makes communities stronger or makes community weaker. We do have one question. I know there are a number of testifiers, but I think we have two questions from members. I want to do those right away, and then I think you've got some testifiers you wish to come forward. So let me begin with Representative Mulder and then Representative O'Neill. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just I wanted a point of clarification here. You were talking about stays and stays of adjudication. And this bill isn't limited to just stays of adjudication. It's the way I read it, right? I mean, all guilty pleas would be impacted by this. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, Representative, that's correct. And, the issue here is that so often in the court caseload, this is what does happen, that these stays are offered. But you're absolutely right. It provides for relief at any point of the prosecutorial process.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talk about the relief part for the collateral consequences, can you talk about how it's similar or different or why this is maybe better than doing the expungement process? Because I think that's, unless a testifier is going to come up and talk about that, but you didn't really talk about that or allude to that in your testimony. It'd be nice to have that comparison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I think some of our testifiers will talk to that, but I'll just respond briefly. The expungement process is after the fact. This process, the order of limited relief, can be after the fact. Somebody can apply for it, but it can also be pretrial. It can be during sentencing or so it's a process that would allow for conversation before a plea is entered or before a sentence is handed down around the specific circumstances of collateral consequences that might apply to the individual. So, for example, if there's a if they're in a profession that is licensed and they know that that license is going to be forfeited by a plea, there could be a conversation about, well, could this be, could there be a limited relief for this particular license in the context of this plea?
Just a quick question.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just narrowly focusing, thinking on the relief side of it. I understand that this is wonderful information that they should have if they're going to enter into a plea particularly, and that's great because, you know, the vast majority of cases are resolved through pleas. In Wright County, it's approaching 80%. No, excuse me. Approaching 90% that are resolved with pleas. And so that part I understand, but I'm just meaning the narrow part of relief after. So if it's essentially the same, I don't know. I'm trying to understand how it's same, different, or.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, so the after-the-fact relief is a little different than an expungement. The expungement would be removing the record, the entirety of the criminal record, right? In this instance, it would be a petition for a specific relief from a specific collateral consequence. So you could come to the court and ask for just relief from a specific collateral consequence after the fact. I think one of the benefits of making this before the fact, though, is that you don't have to have an additional process before the court necessarily. You don't have to get another representation, get a public defender to come back a second time. You can do it right away with your current defense counsel and have that negotiation up front.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's an important distinction.
Indeed. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Johnson.
I'm just going through this, and it's quite a bit of changes to our statutes and some of our laws, and a lot of requirements being done. Has there been just wondering if there's been a fiscal note requested.
Well, let me ask, defer to our fiscal analyst, Mr. John Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, a fiscal note has been requested. The bill was just introduced on Monday, and so the fiscal note is due 10 days from the request date. It should be in, I believe, sometime next week.
Representative Johnson.
One other thing, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, Representative Johnson.
I'm also wondering, since the petition of relief for collateral consequences imposes additional requirements on the courts, does this bill need to go to judiciary?
That's true. Representative Johnson, we do have the judiciary chair here. We've been in conversation. We've been in conversation on this bill for quite a while. It's our feeling at this point that there's no need to do that, but I certainly want to work collegially with our Judiciary Civil Law Committee. There are lots of overlaps, as you well know, in terms of these bills, and so it's important that the Chair Lesh and myself are in constant communication to see whether or not we need to have redundant hearings. At this point, our decision has been that there's no need to do that with this bill. Representative Johnson.
I'm disappointed to hear that because I have quite a few of my members on the judiciary that are not on this committee. And I think looking through, there's a lot of things dealing with the judiciary. And also on Chapter 609B. This bill actually repeals that entire statute. And one of the things in that statute, which is the collateral consequences statute, is 609D.121. Child abuse, sexual abuse, or similar convictions, revocations, or denial of a teacher's automatic denials of a teacher's license. We have those in statute because we don't want a teacher who's convicted or a child abuser to have a teacher's license to be teaching our kids. So we really need to take a good look at this, and I think the judiciary and possibly in civil law should be a good place to look at some of these issues.
Representative Johnson, this committee exists exactly to do what you're asking us to do. We're not going to pass this bill out today. We're going to have a lengthy conversation. I hope that the authors of the bill just heard the issue that you've raised so that we can begin to address that issue as well as the testifiers. I do want to make sure that we're very careful about addressing issues that really are within the scope of this committee and drawing a fine line between procedural issues that are appropriately before the Judiciary Committee. And that's why the chair of that committee and I are in constant communication over this. But rest assured, members, this bill is not going to go anywhere unless we have a thorough vetting of it in this committee. With that, Representative Hertas, we've got a number of testifiers. I want to ask testifiers in the room if we can be concise in our statements, because there are quite a few of you here, and I do want to hear, we do want to hear from you, and we also have another bill that we want to hear from before we adjourn here today. So, Representative Hertas, take us away.
Well, thank you, and we'll certainly call some of those folks up, and they can get on deck. And as they're coming up, I just, you know, to give you some sense of the magnitude of this issue, even on a federal level, there are 77 million people in the federal database. That's a stunning number of people. And I'm not suggesting that because they're in the database, they're criminals, but nonetheless, you know, the collateral consequences that come with brushing or having infractions with the law are significant.
Very well. I welcome the first testifiers here. I do want everyone to know that I'll be grabbing your attention to keep you moving along if the testimony begins to push us beyond the time of our adjournment, because I do want to make sure that we're respectful to everyone in the room who wants to speak so that there's an opportunity for them to do so. So, gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Whoever's going to start first, please give your name for the record, and let's hear your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I will go first. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for having us here. My name is Scott Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. I am the Chief of Police in the city of Chaska.
Welcome, Chief Knight.
Thank you. I will be brief. I'm here to lend my voice and my colleague's voice in support of this for the reasons that have been said, in that there's nothing automatic here. But it is just, it's procedural justice, and at a time when we're talking about criminal justice reform, it's vitally important that all those impacted don't feel that they have been duped or surprised or not forewarned about every consequence they face. That said, the law, the bill, then provides for potential remedy, two vehicles for them to seek a relief if it is found that it is appropriate. I think it's only fair and just, and that's my thoughts on this.
Thank you, Chief Knight. And you're accompanied by another testifier. If you can give us your name and your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members, audience. I'm Tom Streitz, president of Twin Cities Rise. Twin Cities Rise is an organization, nonprofit, that's existed for 25 years in our community, dedicated to helping those with the most challenges to employment train for and attain meaningful employment. We've served thousands of people over the last 25 years, from Excelsior to Stillwater, most of whom have criminal history. And I can tell you every day I work with people who've been convicted of crimes or have entered into a plea agreement, a stay, who are now prohibited from working in the fields which they trained for their whole life. Yesterday, Mr. Jackie Williams testified with me over in the Senate, and he was in healthcare. He He entered into a plea agreement and can no longer work in healthcare. What I see day after day is men and women who want to work, who've served their time, and now they're locked out of entire fields of work for the rest of their life. So what they usually end up doing, and this is true, I see it every day, they end up compromising, taking a part-time job or a job they don't really fulfill in. Some people drop out entirely and give up on work. That's not the messages we want to send here in the state of Minnesota or across the country. I was fortunate enough last year to participate in the first ever White House Prison Reform Summit. I worked actively to pass the bill that was passed by the United States Senate and Congress and signed by the President that reduced criminal sentences for people with nonviolent drug offenders and eased the path for people to work. Simply put, Twin Cities Rise is about helping people get back on their feet and get into the workforce, reclaim their dignity, the dignity of work, and economic self-independence. And if we can do it at the national level, I know we can do it in Minnesota. And anytime you want me to bring up those individuals who come to Twin Cities Rise looking for employment, who desperately want to work, who desperately want to take care of their families and pay taxes, I'll bring a whole army of them here. They're great people. They deserve another chance. And, you know, with the opioid epidemic, I'll just tell everybody in this room, more and more are coming to our organization saying, I made a mistake, I got addicted, and now I want to work, right? That's the fundamental, I think, premise of this bill. People who've trained for a job, have served their time, deserve the right to get back into the workforce and retain the dignity of work and their independence and take care of their families, pay taxes like the rest of us in this state. Thank you for your time, and thank you, Mr. Author, for your attention. And I want to call out Mr. Tennyson as well. Sir, thank you for all your efforts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Streitz. The organization you lead, Twin Cities Rise, is just an amazing community of people that have done a terrific public service to our state for many years. So thank you for that. Thank you to both of you for the message of dignity, of the importance of people being fully aware at the time of their adjudication, and also for lifting up this idea of hope to be able to be productive in the work in our society. We have some other testifiers. Whoever is going to go first, please give us your name and proceed, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Dreyer, and I am the Member Engagement and Government Affairs Manager for the Minnesota Electrical Association. The Minnesota Electrical Association is an organization of 400 electrical contractors and electrical employers and provides education and government advocacy for its members, most of whom are small employers throughout the state of Minnesota. One of my roles within the association is working with community-based organizations to find talent interested in becoming electrical apprentices. I've worked with Avivo, Goodwill Easter Seals, and the Department of Corrections, to name a few. Over 50% of the talent currently looking for positions within my membership have criminal backgrounds. It takes 4 to 5 years to grow a good electrician. Department of Corrections has started some programs that educate individuals within the system to give them a leg up when they are released. I have even seen an individual that apprenticed under the Department of Corrections electrician to receive 100 hours toward his progression to take his journey worker license within the system. The closer an apprentice is to journey worker status, the more valuable they are to an electrical contractor. While many of my members are interested in giving individuals with criminal backgrounds a chance, members that work on public projects often are reluctant to provide the opportunity. You see, many public construction projects require background checks, and it is not clear what convictions are okay with the project owner and what convictions are prohibited. Many of my members, being small businesses, may only have 2 to 10 employees. They may only work on one project at a time and do not have the flexibility to move an electrician to a different project. The fear of not being able to use an employee on a project could prevent the offer of employment. I have one member that performs a lot of projects in St. Michael's schools. There, it is clear that no one with the charge of sexual assault of a minor can be working on the project. This makes sense. It is a very narrow scope chosen specifically to keep the students safe. Other members have brought projects to my attention where background checks are required without specificity. Again, contractors working on these types of projects, in order to stay compliant, will err on the side of caution when hiring and opt out of giving someone with a criminal background an opportunity. Sometimes people make bad choices. Individuals pay for those choices in the criminal justice system. Once their sentence is completed, they should be allowed to move on to better themselves. In some instances, it makes sense to prohibit employment where it puts public safety at risk. Let's make certain public policy is not further punishing individuals with criminal records unnecessarily. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Dreyer. And please, sir, give us your name and your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Ameth. I'm the Vice President of Career Education and Employment Services for Avivo. For those of you who are not familiar with Avivo, we are a 57-year-old organization that serves 18,000 people annually. We have offices in 26 counties across the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, and Princeton. We provide chemical and mental health treatment support, career training, and employment services, connecting approximately 5,000 individuals to employment each year. We serve a diverse group of clients, with over 70% of our clients being people of color and 80% of our clients having incomes at or below the federal poverty line. Last year, at least 6,286 of our clients were people with criminal backgrounds. Every day we see people who struggle to find employment, housing, and other services, like getting their driver's license, because of their background. One of our participants was a battered mother whose abuser was able to charge her with abuse, and she was convicted of a felony and a misdemeanor. She's currently receiving MPIP services through Avivo, was living in a shelter with her three children, but was not able to stay due to her background. She's now living with family members and on the verge of being homeless. She has been unable to secure employment and stable housing due to her felony record. Another participant of ours was mandated to attend Avivo treatment program after she's released from prison and is currently on intensive supervised release. She took our warehouse training program, was a stellar student with attendance and participation. She received her forklift safety certification upon graduation from the training program. Two significant employers offered her conditional employment pending her background. She went through drug testing, physical testing, and was even set up with orientation start dates at both employers. However, immediately before employment was to start, she was notified that her background would not allow her to work at their companies. Mr. Chair, imagine the frustration and hopelessness that both these people must be feeling. They're trying to put their lives back together and become contributing members of society, and yet they cannot find housing or employment to support their families. These are only two of the hundreds of examples that our team sees every day. With the unemployment rate so low and with the workforce shortage, it's imperative that we find opportunities to make sure that everyone who can work is working. We support this legislation because it would let people know of possible consequences before they plead guilty, would allow them some relief to obtain employment or secure housing, and would provide employers who are willing to hire people with criminal backgrounds some protection. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Ameth. And to you and Ms. Dreyer, refreshing to hear the voice of employers from that sector, as well as those who are working to provide training adjustment, if you will, for folks that are looking to be productive. It does seem to me that I had not thought about this, you know, that the uncertainty perhaps not only lies with those who are in reentry, but also for our businesses in the state of Minnesota. So I really appreciate both your testimony. We have one last scheduled testifier. And Representative Johnson, you have a question for the testifier?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, since we do have the business industry up here, the question I have is that person you're talking about that the company couldn't hire because of their background, was it because something in the state statute, or is it because the insurance company would not allow that person to be hired because of the insurance risk issues?
Representative Ameth, or Mr. Ameth, sorry for the demotion.
Sure. Mr. Ameth, that's a question I'll have to get back to you on that specific circumstance, but it does definitely happen. You are right that there are a number of times we hear from employers that liability is a challenge and one that, you know, they're not necessarily able to kind of reckon with. I think that's a big part of it.
I would imagine, Mr. Ameth, that there's a nexus between liability and what our state statutes allow or don't allow relative to what Representative Hertaus, Representative Long are trying to clear up here today. So a clear signal, it seems to me, would be appropriate hopefully for insurance companies to look at. Thank you for your question, Representative Johnson, please.
And to expound on that a little bit, my wife used to be in property management. And they'd have to do the background checks. And unfortunately, because of some of the backgrounds, people could not be allowed to move into the complex. Because of the insurance companies, because if that person, since you do the background check, you find out they have a background of this history. If the company allows them to move in there, they are liable for any damage if by any other victims if that should happen. So it's more than just this issue. It's a much bigger issue that we have to deal with.
Well, and Representative Johnson, and perhaps that's something that Representative Long and Representative Hertoff can speak to in a moment when they're back up at the witness table. Very well. Thank you, Mr. Ameth. And I believe you are Robert Johnson. And so please give us your name and your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Johnson. I'm a retired prosecutor. I was a prosecutor for about 40 years. The last 28 years, I was the Anoka County attorney. So I was involved with a lot of criminal justice policy, both at the state and national and international level. And I encountered these type of concerns even when I was an assistant back in the 70s and then when I was county attorney in the 80s. Because back at that time, some of you will recall, there were a lot of mandatory minimums in play. So as a prosecutor, our obligation as a prosecutor is to do justice. So when you're going to try to do justice, you have to understand what the consequences of your charges are going to be. So if I'm going to charge somebody that has a three-year mandatory minimum, and I'm going to do that without a pre-sentence investigation, so, you know, I'm just going to charge that, and then I have to see what that person's going to look like and have the public defender or private attorney talk with me about the consequences are going to be. And then I have to play that into either my charges or my plea bargain. So I was running into that, trying to struggle with it. And sometimes the consequences, because the collateral consequences are actually like mandatory minimums. If you're convicted of the crime, you automatically have a collateral consequence that's going to be imposed, regardless of the nature of your offense or regardless of your character. I was also having problems with judges understanding what the consequences were and giving my terribly unfavorable evidentiary rulings during the trial. If I tried to prosecute a police officer, for instance, for a domestic abuse, and that was going to mean that they were going to lose their right to carry a gun, I would have terrible evidentiary rulings. It was really difficult to get a conviction for domestic abuse. So that went on for a number of years, and I could give you any number of stories about actual situations that we faced where the collateral consequences were going to be so severe that we made significantly different charging and plea bargaining decisions. So as time went on, we adjusted our practice, our prosecution practice, to take into account the collateral consequences. And then as it went on, and I realized what these people that we convicted were facing with regard to the statutory barriers for employment, I began to realize that there was a real public safety concern here, because you may not be able to get a license to work in a nursing home, and there are all sorts of statutory barriers to that. But you didn't need a license to sell drugs or burglarize houses. So if we wanted to get these people gainfully employed so that they didn't have to go back out on the street and commit crimes to support themselves and their families, you had to have some mechanism for dealing with those collateral consequences that were going to be imposed as a result of the conviction. And I have to tell you that back when I was in charge of the Financial Crimes Task Force, I had a lot to deal with. And then the Commissioner of public safety, a guy named McCampion, who some of you may remember. He wasn't exactly a weak-kneed liberal.
I do remember the commissioner, county attorney Johnson. I do want us to keep moving along, though.
Okay, so
if we can wrap up, that'd be terrific.
I very much support this bill, and it will increase public safety significantly, and it will create less burdens from the prosecution side.
Thank you. Thank you, County Attorney Bob Johnson. Thank you for your many years of service to Anoka County and to the good people of Minnesota. I also am advised that you are an advisor to the Uniform Law Commission Committee that drafted the collateral consequences framework that Representative Hertas and Representative Long are working from. And with that, I do want to acknowledge Mr. Bob Tennyson, who is a commissioner of the Uniform Law Commission. There are questions, and so I want to go to Representative Bowler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be brief here. So I just have a couple of questions about how this would work in like a post-conviction or appeal setting, because I know that this bill says this isn't a reason to invalidate a plea. And then perhaps, Mr. Johnson, you'd be able to answer this, but we know that people can move to withdraw their plea if it's not voluntary, knowing, or intelligent. That's a I'm an appellate attorney, and I see that kind of argument a lot. And so I'm worried that this language that says this won't actually prevent people from trying then after the fact to withdraw their plea by saying we didn't know of all the collateral consequences. And just one more piece to that, and in part I'm concerned about that because of what we saw happen after the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Padilla case and the immigration consequences, and how you know, there was a lot of confusion about what kind of information should we be giving and who should be giving that. So if you could address that, would be very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. That's certainly true. That's why we want to try to inform people of what the consequences are of the conviction. And that's why we provide that there should be notice given and that there is a responsibility on the part of the defense attorney to advise them with regard to, like, immigration consequences and other consequences that are going to come about as a result of the guilty plea or the conviction. And once they have had an opportunity to meet with their defender and talk about the possible consequences, one of the things that I particularly like about it is that if there are some consequences that you know about and are a barrier to the offender, you can deal with it during a part of the criminal process in the plea so that you may be able to remove that statutory barrier as a part of the plea. But it does have a responsibility for the offender and the defense attorney to have a knowingly and an understanding of what the consequences of the conviction would be.
Representative Mulder. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's my concern, because apparently the American Bar Association has identified over 38,000 consequences. And so how can we guarantee that we're giving them all of the right consequences? And then what happens after the fact if we haven't given, you know, if that information hasn't been given? I really appreciate the intent behind that, behind this bill, but that's just my concern about that. And we're going to see a lot of people trying to withdraw their plea.
There's always going to be a problem with the offender fully understanding what the consequences of conviction are going to be, whether it's collateral or direct. I mean, if you're going to have a conviction, there has to be a discussion with the defense attorney with regard to what this is going to mean, not just the collateral consequences, but just having a record is going to have an impact on you. I wrote a column once that said every conviction is forever, because once it's in the database and you pull it up, you're going to see that conviction, whether it's for a drug offense or it's something else, and that's going to have an impact. So you have to understand if you're charged with a crime, there are going to be consequences that are going to last far beyond the conviction for that crime, whether it's by plea or by trial. And you can just do the best you can to explain that. And that is, you know, whether it's a direct consequence or an indirect consequence. And we're talking about indirect consequences that are consequences, but there are also direct consequences just of having a conviction.
So perhaps some ongoing food for thought for the authors as we continue to go forward. Quickly, Representative.
Yep, and one more different question has to do with the effective date. I'm also concerned about retroactivity, so it looks like the effective date is just the date of enactment. So then for all of those people who weren't informed of these consequences prior to this date, are they going to all come forward and say my plea is invalid now because I wasn't? And I just don't know if we need to tweak that language at all. Or
well, they should be having these discussions, I mean, now, even before this bill, because there is a list of collateral consequences in the statutes. And defenders should be having this discussion with their clients right now. And it should be expanded after this bill passes. And I appreciate your reference, Mr. Chairman, to the ABA, because the ABA was what really took this issue up, and from there to the Uniform Law Commission.
Indeed. Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to respond quickly to Representative Mollard. I think that's a fair question about how this could be interpreted in the courts, and it seems like there may be some ability to work on language that would express that it's not our intent that an individual could come petition after the fact and say that this gives a rise to a claim. I think that would be worth discussing.
Good question. It allows us to be able to state for the record what the author's intents are. Members, we are past the time that the chair had hoped we would be done with this bill. We do have another bill up, and it does have quite a few members in the public that want to speak to it. Representative O'Neill, however, I do have you on the list.
Thank you. I will try to be very concise. So I was handed this wonderful document from former Senator Tennyson. Thank you. Oh, he's not there anymore. He moved. Anyway, I just wanted to point out a few things that he – I'm just going to get to this really quickly. Just a few things that I think we need to have on the public record. One is the burden of proof. And correct me if I'm wrong on any of these points, but this comes from Mr. Tennyson, that it's preponderance of evidence, okay, where you have expungement, which is clear and convincing, which is a higher bar. I think we should just know that on the record. Also, for the procedure, it could be an ex parte hearing, which is very different than expungement. Because the reason that in expungement it's a much more intense hearing is because you also have victim impact statements, and you consider that. And I'm a little concerned that, one, it's an ex parte hearing, and two, that there is, at least on the face of this, that there is little or no hearing from the victim, you know, if there is a victim in this case. And then finally, other states. And so for this, the petitioner could seek relief from convictions in other states, and where expungement, you cannot. And so that might be a good thing or bad thing, but it's a difference that's very stark, that if you have convictions from other states, you can also seek relief here. And maybe that's a great thing, but just something that we should consider as we move forward. But I would ask you to consider there are cases where the victims' voices are not heard through this process, where they are in expungement, and I think that's something that probably should be considered. That's as fast as I can do it, Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. And Representative Johnson, very quickly, because we're about to lay this bill on the table.
Yeah, real quickly, I just wondered if at some point we'll bring this up, if whether the county attorneys, the judicial branch, or somebody could answer this question. If somebody is not, if we pass this and somebody is not law enforcement or the defense attorney or the prosecutor or whoever fails to give them all the information, is that conviction then now thrown out?
Representative Long, Representative Pertos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, this does not throw out any convictions. There is no specific rise to a cause of action that's created by this bill. To the point Representative Mueller made, you could argue that you weren't given specific notice in certain situations, but you can do that now as well.
Very well. Representative Johnson?
I'm just concerned if we're putting this in statute with some of the requirements. I've seen more than one case thrown out because an officer didn't do something that was required under statute. So I'm just concerned on that we might have some convictions overturned of some very serious crimes.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I think we're here for so long, we will continue to vet that particular
very quickly, Mr. Chair. The only point I'll notice is that the bill does, I think, a nice job of trying to make the notice requirement very easy and actually spells out what the notice requirement should be. So it should be pretty uniform for folks to be able to receive notice, and hopefully there won't be a lot of ambiguity.
Certainly not a point to be taken lightly. Representative Hertaus, you have the last word here.
Thank you. And just a quick reply to the ex parte question. You know, not in all circumstances are offenses necessarily involve a victim. And part of the intent of that was where there isn't somebody opposing what you're requesting is that an individual, without having to have an attorney, can go before a judge, explain the circumstances, and ask for some relief that would be ordered. So that's kind of the idea. And in closing, kind of think of this a little bit how a lot of other things in our life affect us. I come from the world of real estate, and we have to do disclosure. We have to tell you if there's a leaky roof, if the basement ever leaked, if there methamphetamines were ever produced on the property. There's all sorts of disclosures. It's endless disclosures in real estate. And I kind of liken this a little bit to the same thing. You're about to enter the world of the law, and just some obligation to inform those who are accused exactly what all the consequences might be and what that might mean with regard to your willingness to take a stay of adjudication or any type of plea deal. So thank you for your time, and I know there's a lot of work maybe yet to do in judiciary, but thank you, Chair Mariani.
Representative Hertaus, a terrific illustration, analogy. I was shuddering thinking about many closings that I've been at, and how my hand would just get tired of signing. So, with that, the chair lays House File 981 as amended, for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Long and Representative Hertaus. Members, we now have House File 741, Representative Doar. Now, who's going to be amendment?
Oh, it is this.
Very well. Representative Doar, the chair will move House File 741, and the motion is that it be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. And so your bill is before us, and Representative Doar, the chair will then also move your amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Why don't we hold on a second? Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure, but I didn't see any snacks going around, and I believe this is Representative Neuer's first bill in this committee, and I didn't want that to impede anybody's ability to vote one way or another on this bill. They may be undernourished, so I just wanted to make sure that that was, you know, at least addressed.
Representative Nash, I'm kind of leaning not to vote for it.
You look a little peckish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I didn't forget that.
You're in for a real treat.
Some boosters are coming around, so.
There you go.
Oh, this is passing out of here really quick.
This is a high bar.
Mr. Chair, this committee is getting some boosters. This committee is getting some boosters because of my CLA sitting up front there doing all the good work. So, thank you, Jason.
Representative Doar, I do have a soft spot for some boosters.
Appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
We do have your bill before us, and the chair is going to move the A2. Amendment as well, so we can get the bill shaped up the way you want it before us. And so with that, all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Doar, your bill is before us as amended. Look forward to your testimony and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill requires courts to release defendants charged with misdemeanor offenses with the exclusion of DWI, domestic assault, DANCO, assault on fifth degree, stalking, harassment, restraining order. Mr. Chair, this bill allows defendants, releases defendants on their personal recognizance unless the court determines that there's substantial likelihood that defendant will not appear at future court hearings. Mr. Chair, this is really dehumanizing to see many people who will plead guilty because they cannot afford to pay for cash bail. This is what I simply call criminalizing people because they cannot pay simple $100 or even more, and we keep them in jail, which really impacts their livelihood. They may lose their job, they may lose their housing, they may lose their children just because they cannot afford to pay simple cash bail. This is not to open the gateway for everything. We are addressing only misdemeanor cases with the exclusion of few that I just named. Members, Mr. Chair, this is providing justice to folks who have been left out. This is providing equity in our system. We cannot allow a system whereby a young person who goes through the system for the first time, being told that if you cannot pay for cash bail, you are not going to go home. I've seen this in many times in the court system, where they just plead guilty, which impacts their life for the rest of their life. This is injustice in our criminal justice system that we can take care of. I know I've had a lot of discussions with many members in the community when I was campaigning, even beyond that. It's because we need to create a system that is fair and just for everyone, regardless of their income, their zip code, who they look like. The cash bail system, actually, for those who are low income and people of color and indigenous, are the ones who are disproportionately impacted by this cash bail system. And if we want to change the pipeline to prison, from school to prison, even to deportation, this is the first step that we need to start looking into and reducing the number of people in our jail system. So, Mr. Chair and members, there are many people who wanted to testify. I've got a book to discuss about, but I would like to allow Hennepin County Commissioner Marion Green to come and testify before this.
Very well. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Noor. Commissioner Green, what a pleasure to see you again, and welcome back to the body that you and I both served together for a number of years.
Yes, thank you so much. It's a delight to be here in front of this august and highly esteemed body. My name is Marion Green, and as is alluded to, I'm a former state representative and current county commissioner at Hennepin County and chair of the county board. I want to thank Representative Noor for bringing forward this bill that would reduce the use of financial conditions in misdemeanor offenses. And I'm here today to speak in support of HF 741. This is a valuable launching pad, and a lot of critical thinking is needed on this topic, as Representative Noor alluded. This is a topic that Hennepin County, along with all criminal justice stakeholders, has been discussing since 2017, when we saw a lot of system stressors, including a ballooning jail population in the spring of 2017. In Hennepin County, we commissioned a system analysis of jail population drivers and trends. Two retired judges presented their recommendations in December just of last year. And the system analysis was intended to examine this spike in jail population that we had seen in the spring of the previous year. As a result of this overcrowding, an excess of $1 million was spent in overtime to adequately staff inmate overflow, meet staffing guidelines, and address concerns over safety of deputies and inmates. So as you can see, there are financial ramifications for local government as well as the social justice ramifications of different systems for people who are poor or lower income versus people who have money. One of the recommendations made out of this study was to seriously consider bail reform proposals to provide relief from jail overcrowding and allow the county to join the national reform effort. There was consensus on the fact that no one wanted to build more jail beds. Also recently was a one-day snapshot study conducted by the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office last December that examined whether socioeconomic disparities exist in the criminal justice system. I say that with some irony because I think it's well known that they, of course, do. But this was about the data. The Sheriff's Office snapshot study consisted of a self-reported survey of inmates at the Hennepin County Jail with over 90% responding. More than 70% reported their household income as less than $30,000 annually, meaning the majority of jail inmates earn less than one-third of their fellow Minnesota residents. 88% reported being unable to afford their court-ordered bail, with 71% on nonviolent charges. So there, basically because they couldn't pay the bail. There is a human and social cost of unnecessary incarceration and misuse of our jails on both arrestees and their wider network. And I say their wider network, but of course their wider network is our wider network. The poorest of our society are unduly affected by incarceration. There should be no criminal penalties for being poor. Bail reform efforts in Minnesota should focus on the original purpose of bail, guaranteeing against the risk of failure to appear. Guaranteeing against the risk of failure to appear. More and more cities and counties across the nation are recognizing on a bipartisan basis that significant percentages of those held in jails are not a threat to the public and are being housed at an incredible cost. Criminal justice reform in the United States has been a topic of discussion for years. States are increasingly taking strides to reform the criminal justice system and to alleviate the systemic burdens on our poorest residents. I'd be delighted for the state of Minnesota to join these efforts. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Green. If you can hang around for questions, that'd be wonderful because we do have a long list of testifiers.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to call Leslie Redmond from NAACP.
Representative Noor, thank you. And welcome, Ms. Redmond, to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Grace and peace, everyone. Again, my name is Leslie Redmond, and I have the honor and privilege of serving as the president for the Minneapolis NAACP, also known as the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Before I begin my testimony today, I would like to start by saying happy Black History Month. I've been with you all week, and we've talked a lot about regional disparities. But what we haven't talked quite enough about is racial disparities. And that's shocking to me because we're in the state of Minnesota. And as many of you may and should know, we have some of the worst racial disparities in the nation. And that's something that we should be uncomfortable about because Minnesota, time and time again, is ranked at the best. However, we're always constantly putting our Black residents to the back. I won't go into the data too much because it's easily accessible and well documented. But what I will say is that Minnesota has historically and continues to deprive Black people of opportunities to wealth, housing, education, and so forth. When we think about the criminal justice system, this is a larger issue. I often think to the 13th Amendment. Where in this great nation, when we abolished slavery, we said, except if you're duly convicted of a crime. And coincidentally, the descendants of those same individuals are now trapped in mass incarceration and our criminal justice system, not many times because of public safety issues, but because of poverty. We have an opportunity today to support Representative Noor Bill, and I believe we have a duty and obligation to do so. It would be disappointing to see politics and ignorance get in the way of justice and progression. In Minnesota, we have to acknowledge that there's an invisible architecture of oppression. And if you don't see it, it's probably because you're not wanting to and you're not looking hard enough. Some of the committee members talked about regional discretion and being able to apply the law differently in different places. And I don't know if I mentioned, but I'm finishing up my JD MBA at the University of St. Thomas in May. We talk a lot about natural law. Aquinas said an unjust law is not a law at all. I like to say when we create laws that either intentionally or unintentionally create racial disparities, we have a duty and obligation to fix them. And again, today we are presented with the opportunity, so we must take it. We have an opportunity to move forward together. And even if we can't agree on regional disparities, I would hope that in 2019, we can agree that Black people should not be discriminated against because of the color of their skin. Now, we use MLK's words against him quite often. When he said we didn't want to be discriminated against the color of our skin, but the content of our character, we've now created a loophole when it comes to race. Black people are constantly disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system, and we need to correct that. You all have an opportunity today, and I hope that you all will take it. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Redmond, and thank you for your leadership at the NAACP and for your counsel as well here over the course of the last couple of months. I'm sorry. Very good. Representative Newark.
Mr. Chair, I've got Benjamin Feist from ACLU.
Welcome again to the committee, Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me again today. It's a really great discussion. I'm glad we're able to open this up, an important issue of cash bail reform. And I want to thank Representative Knorr for bringing this bill. The ACLU has been looking at issues of bail reform across the country. We're working currently in at least 33 states at different ways to approach this issue. We believe this is really essential because money bail has proven to be one of the most broken parts of the justice system. This unfair and unjust system punishes those who are not wealthy even before they've had a chance to defend themselves in court, and disproportionately impacts black people and other people of color. These disparities can be substantial, as we've already heard. Black people are more likely than white people to remain in jail after an arrest, even where they are charged the same offense and have a similar history. Cities, counties, and states across the country are moving to end wealth-based detention. These efforts aim to make sure people aren't locked up simply because they can't afford bail and that they can return home while awaiting their day in court. This bill is, again, a great opportunity to start the discussion. I think there's a lot of work to do, but it's important that we are looking at this not just at the county level, but also to see what the legislature can do to improve the situation. While this bill is a meaningful step in the right direction, we also believe that it doesn't go far enough to address substantial problems in our broken system. For example, we would suggest addressing pre-booking diversion and including similar mechanisms for release for non-misdemeanor offenses in future reforms. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. And if you can hang around for questions, that would be terrific. Representative Noor, do you have other testifiers?
Yes, indeed, Mr. Chair. I've got Jacob Krauss from Jewish Action Center.
Very well. And Representative Noor, do you?
Karen is here, so.
Representative Noor, I'm just wondering if you have others, perhaps they can just make their way to the front so that we can maximize.
There's a list of individuals, if they can walk to the back so that you can have a chance to speak.
Yeah, my understanding is State Public Defender Ward and also someone from, I presume, the Minneapolis City Attorney, Mary Hagg. If you can come forward, that way we can just quickly move right into testimony. And with that, who's up next? Jacob Krauss?
We switch things up. Thank you for having me. I'm actually Karen Rotz. I'm the Executive Director of Jewish Community Action.
Very well.
Yeah.
Welcome to our committee.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. Mazel tov on your bill in committee. It's great. Like I said, I'm Karen Rotz. I'm Executive Director of Jewish Community Action. I'm representing my members here today in support of House File 741. Jewish Community Action organizes Jews for racial and economic justice in Minnesota, and we absolutely recognize the cash bail system as a tool of injustice. As a Jewish community, Jewish organization, we're committed to some core values. One of those values is something we call Pidyon Shvuyim. It's a teaching from the Talmud which gives us very clear instructions about freeing captives who are held unjustly. We're also taught to judge one another fairly and to not favor the poor or show deference to the rich. The cash bail system, which exists at the intersection of mass poverty and mass incarceration, places those who can afford bail over those who cannot, regardless of the crime someone is charged with or even whether or not they're guilty. The intent of cash bail is to make sure that people make it to a court appearance, to make it to a court appearance. That implies that the person has been released, has gone somewhere else, pending that appearance. The structure of cash bail presumes that someone is able to afford the bail, that they will pay it, will leave jail, resume their work, their family life, and will come back to make a court appearance at a later assigned date. To assign cash bail to someone you know will never be able to pay it is an operation in bad faith. It violates the intent to send someone home and make sure they come back. And while that may have been the intent, the cash bail system has evolved into a tool of criminalization. It leaves too many people incarcerated for a long time before they've even had a trial because of their inability to pay bail. Today, we're locking up thousands of Minnesotans who've not yet even been found innocent or guilty. We're keeping people in jail. We're criminalizing people who have not yet even faced judgment simply for lacking money. The system magnifies disparities between the rich and poor, between people of color and indigenous people and white people. And as Leslie said, especially in a state like Minnesota, with such vast racial disparities in income, access to housing and healthcare, education, and of course, incarceration. Pretrial incarceration, being held for an inability to pay bail, it has enormous consequences even for a short period of time. Incarcerated people, remember people who have not yet even been found guilty or innocent, are often fired from their jobs for absenteeism. They're evicted for not paying rent, deprived of custody of their children. Children lose their parents. They miss school. And locking up people who cannot afford bail may also pressure them into entering a guilty plea simply so they can return to their daily lives, even if they are not guilty. They're incentivized to plead guilty, even if innocent, just to get back to their family. Additionally, for most people, going to trial is incredibly stressful and a difficult process. Everyone deserves the right to enter that process with the support of their community and family. Again, I'm representing Jewish Community Action. I cannot overstate how central this is to us, the ability to be in community and to be supported by one's community, especially in difficult moments. That can't happen when someone sits in jail simply for not having enough money to go home. And it's clear that this type of system does not serve the interests of justice. JCA has been working on criminal justice reform for several years at the state and local level. At a time when so much of the conversation about incarceration in policy spaces like this one is focused on how to open more prisons, who should run those prisons or profit from those prisons, we think nobody should profit from those prisons, or how to create more beds and who should fill those beds, and we know that beds actually equals people. We believe that the path to equity, to justice, and to real public safety is dealing with the fact that we are incarcerating too many people, often for too long and for the wrong reasons. This bill is an easy opportunity to begin to shift a small piece of that. Jewish Community Action supports House File 741 because it will help us move away from a system that criminalizes poverty towards a system that promotes equity and public safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ross. And is it Pidioch Runin?
Sorry. Pidyon.
Pidyon.
Shvuyim.
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 Okay, I'm going to work on it.
Yeah, we'll do Hebrew out in the hall after.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So to the testifiers, we're going to have to move quickly, or quicker, I guess is the word. With testimony with that, I'm going to have our state public defender, Mr. Bill Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I think it's important to think about the subjects that have been before this committee this week, and I'm not being facetious on this. You're hearing we do not have a criminal justice system. We have a criminal court system, plain and simple. I want to talk to you about a few facts, and I will be brief. And these facts are brought out about from our own pretrial justice work group that was chaired by Judge McBride. And the facts are from the Pretrial Justice Institute. Unconvicted inmates account for 95% of jail growth from 2000 to 2014. Obviously, that 95% is of people who are presumed innocent of their charges. Nearly one half of Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency. And without being hyperbolic here, close your eyes. If you had to come up with $400 in cash, debit, or credit card for a family member, I'll bet you nearly every single person in this room could do that. My clients can't. They are the indigent accused. They are the ones who are suffering in jail, presumed innocent, because they can't come up with that $200, $300, $500, and they're sitting there. Race and bond amounts are related, period. Bail amounts that are set at 35% higher for African-American men, 19% higher for Hispanic men charged with the same crime and have the same background or criminal background and history. Nationally, 50% of pretrial detainees are African-American men or Latinos, compared to 30% of the population. And those who are released at some point prior to trial, compared to those who are in custody, the ones in custody are four times greater of being sentenced to jail, three times greater for longer jail sentences, three times greater for longer prison lengths, and three times greater chance of going to prison, and two times longer prison population sentences. This state has a great constitution and rule. Nobody's following it. We have the idea of presumptive release. It's not being followed. Unless the appearance can otherwise be guaranteed, a person should be released on bail, but they're not. So even with the knowledge of the information I've given you that's known by the bench, that's known by the prosecutors, even with the knowledge of presumption of release and about the knowledge about a guarantee against no excessive bail, pretrial incarceration permeates our 87 counties. It is criminalizing the poor. They're the ones who are affected. So basically, based upon the practices in our counties, we have institutionalized de facto culture of unconstitutional preventative detention. There are two ways of dealing with that. One way is supporting this bill. The second is to follow up on pretrial risk assessments and having those applied evenly throughout the 87 counties. I encourage you to pass this bill. It is a step, but it's a step in the right direction.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. And I take it you're Ms. Hang?
No, but I do have my wonderful criminal deputy who is an amazing reformer here, Mary Ellen Hang. I am Susan Siegel. I am the city attorney for the city of Minneapolis.
Very well. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much. And I heard somebody say, oh, Lord, who shall remain nameless, as the group of us were walking up here to testify. So we will be very brief. In Hennepin and Ramsey counties, and we're the only counties like this in the state, I believe, where municipal prosecutors prosecute adult gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor crime. And we have, over the last several years, made a lot of progress. There is so much more work to be done. I have the honor of working with Bill when he was chief public defender in Hennepin County, and I know our office partners very closely with Mary Moriarty, who is the current chief public defender, and other criminal justice reform stakeholders. We are very supportive of this bill generally, with the addition that I saw some amendments that are on their way that deal with domestics and some of the other offenses where there is a public safety risk. For our cases now, it is very rare for Minneapolis misdemeanants to be in jail, except for those few who are chronic failures to appear. And that is something that, you know, is another part of this I'll talk about for a moment.
Ms. Moriarty, I'm afraid I'm going to have to rush you along here.
Okay, I will rush along, but one thing I want to say is that there's we have achieved a 53% reduction in arrests over time. We are going to pass out a handout here on some of the work we've already done. We are working toward comprehensive statewide bail reform.
There is a page that can help with that.
Yeah, and I will leave it there, but happy to answer any questions.
Thank you much. We do have one question, but I want to get this last testifier in, then Representative Nash, you're on the top of the list. And I'm guessing you're Mr. Brown, but I might be wrong.
You are absolutely right, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I'm David Brown. I'm the Chief Deputy Hennepin County Attorney. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the County Attorneys Association. The association had asked me to let you know the bill was just introduced. They have not taken a position on it. I believe they've already met with Representative Noor to talk about policy issues. What I was really asked here to address, and Ms. Siegel did some of that and we're passing some out, is the idea of bail reform is not new to us in Hennepin County or the city of Minneapolis. This is something that I also want to call out, Ms. Hang, we've been working on for a number of years. We have a validated risk assessment tool where we have applied some science to these decisions, and we've been doing that for a lot of years. The court system is rolling that out statewide now. So what's only been in Hennepin is now being rolled out statewide. But even on low-level felonies, the county attorney's office has taken some proactive work to increase the number of summonses where somebody's not taken into custody on a felony. They're asked to come to court. And what we added to that last year was a book and release. So if somebody doesn't show up on that first summons, we're not going out and arresting them. They'll go out and get them, bring them down, get them booked into court, but they're not held in jail. They'll arrest them, but they will not hold them in jail. They'll give them a new court date and let them go. So we're trying to find ways both in the misdemeanor world, in the lower level felony world, to keep people out so that the people we have in there are the people that we're really worried about for public safety, are the ones that don't come back to court. And we're very conscious of that issue. And so thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. All right, members, we are at the time of adjournment. The committee that typically meets after us does not meet on Thursday. So here's what I want to do. We do have at least one question right now. We've asked Mr. Ward to stick around because I think it's going to be for him. What I want to do is spend the next 10 minutes with questions. And there are a number of people who do want to testify against your bill, Representative Noren, so I do want to hear from them. So we're going to do a check-in. Actually, we'll do a check-in in about 5 minutes. And then we'll play it by ear. The chair is certainly willing to stay here for a period of time. We do have caucus for both caucuses after this committee, and then we have a floor session. If we lose enough members, we're probably either going to have to hear this again later this evening or on another date. And so I want everyone to keep that in mind as you're asking questions and you're answering questions as well. So with that, Representative Nash, I'm going to turn to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you were sort of reading my mind. Some of us actually have some constituents that we're expecting after this at our regularly appointed committee time. I would ask that we table this, pick it up next week. I know that many of my members have a lot of questions. Many people, as you already know, wish to testify against this. It just seems like a fair thing to do to bring it back next week during our regularly scheduled time. You don't have to bring any more snacks. If you want to, that'd be great. But, Mr. Chair, I just would ask that we actually table this, bring it back next week, because there's a lot of discussion that people would like to have, and I think rushing it on a time clock where we have to scramble back to get our LAs to kick people down the road, I just think that it would be better if we brought it up next week.
Representative Nash, that's not bad counsel. I'm actually resisting my committee administrator's counsel on this.
But I would move to table it.
But let me hold on a second. We don't need a motion here. Let me just say this, and Representative Johnson, you raised this question at the beginning of the hearing, and now you have a demonstration of why the chair notified committee members of our need to begin having evening meetings. And that's either good or bad. It's just full disclosure, transparent for everyone. This will certainly be jamming us up next week, and so certainly do expect us to have evening meetings. And I do not want to quell questions whatsoever. It's our duty to do that. I just want everyone to be aware that as we do our duty, we're going to be spending a lot of time in this room in the coming weeks. So with that, Representative Johnson, I believe you have a comment or a question.
I made a motion, though.
Representative Nash, I would really ask you not to move forward with that motion, and let's just talk this through for a bit.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I understand Representative Nash's issue. I, too, have a constituent waiting in my office. Supposed to meet him in 10 minutes. But I also have a little bit of question for the Minneapolis prosecutor.
And that, I believe, is Ms. Moriarty?
Siegel.
Where did I get Moriarty? Wow. Touché. Ms. Siegel.
And I may defer the question to Mary Ellen Hang because she actually knows what's going on, but we're here.
Very well. Ms. Moriarty. Oh, wait a minute. Are you Siegel?
Yes.
I'm Siegel. This is Mary Ellen Hang, who runs Where's our criminal Marty? Division.
She works for me.
All right. Why don't you give us your name and provide us some thoughts on Representative Johnson's question.
I haven't asked the question yet.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I know it's been a little over 6 years since I've been in a courtroom. As many of you know, I was a former law enforcement. I spent way too much time in the courtroom unfortunately, I think I had 99.99% of my cases as convictions. But when I'd be there, and there's times I'd have to go there as the bailiff when he had situations come up, and we'd be having the bail hearings for the people in custody from the previous night or over the weekend. And yes, there is a generally set bail amount, but I remember my county attorney and my city prosecutors requesting what the bail amount should be. And my question to, since both of them are up there, when you're at these bail hearings, do you not have the option to request bail or set the bail at whatever you guys want? So if you wanted to not have bail, you could do that already?
Ms. Siegel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, bail is actually set by the court. But yes, we do, as prosecutors, we can request certain amounts. That is true. You know, and in Minneapolis, we've used our discretion as prosecutors with a risk assessment tool that's used to allow most people on, you know, on these lower level misdemeanors to be released on their own recognizance without bail or any other conditions.
Ms. Siegel, I believe what we have before us, Representative Noor's bill, is about state policy on this. So I think there's some gap or different, I'm not quite sure what the word is, but there's local policy and practices, and then there's guidance that the state can provide to you, and that's what's before us here today. Am I correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. In state law, there are maximum bail amounts in state law.
Okay, very well. Representative Johnson?
Chair, that's a little bit of my point. There's maximum. There is no minimum. If the prosecutor doesn't want any bail, they can request no bail. But they do have to go to the court hearing because the judge has set that. I'm concerned that issues in different parts of the state are different. But I'm just leave it at there right now. I got a lot of concerns on this bill, but we haven't had any of the proponents or the opponents on this bill even come close to testifying that at this point we are pretty much out of time.
Representative Johnson, this committee adjourns when the committee votes to adjourn, or the chair lowers the gavel. Representative Lash, I'll have you have the last comment or question, and then I'll make a determination about what our next steps are going to be. Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Johnson, I just wanted to tell you that, you know, having been a prosecutor for the city for 15 years, you've got a certain culture in certain offices. And one of my first terms here, we voted to expand bail for domestics considerably more. That was the hot topic of the day, and it was the suggestion that we wanted to make sure we kept folks charged with domestics in jail longer, and so we allotted for much higher bail for like a misdemeanor domestic than we would for a misdemeanor or anything else. That's also happened with DWIs, where there is a state mandatory minimum on that of what you got to be set for bail. And that's the product of years of sort of bureaucratic creep or get tough on crime creep for various areas. Now, if you got an office policy, let's say for Ms. Siegel or someone else, that's something that still needs to trickle down to the line attorneys on the job. And also a bench culture gets created in different counties on that. And that's why I think, even though, while you're technically correct, that Ms. Siegel could direct Ms. Hang to tell her prosecutors to, hey, ask this much on bail, it takes a while to filter down there, and it takes a while for that culture to catch on with the bench as well. And I think a state policy that we set here is pivotal in making that happen faster and more uniformly. So I just wanted to add that qualification.
Thank you. Chair Lesh, in addition to that, state policy wants to speak to racial disparities, which has clearly been identified here today. The motion, which we're not going to do today, the motion is to send this to your committee, Chair Lesh, where these kind of questions can be much more fully vetted. And Representative Johnson, I note that you're on that committee as well. So, members, here's what we're going to do before we adjourn. We're going to reconvene on Tuesday to finish this bill. please watch your Tuesday evening. That's right, because we do have our regular meeting on Tuesday. So we'll take this up on Tuesday evening. So we'll recess at our regular time on Tuesday, because we have a full day of hearing already scheduled for that day. I don't know the time yet. The chair has a few commitments, including a meeting with our Senate counterpart that evening. So watch for notices, but we'll come back. And my apologies to those who are present here that still wanted to testify on this bill. I hope that you can also stay in touch with the chair's office. Watch our website so that you're duly informed of when we would reconvene. So with that, the chair lays House File 741 as amended on the table. And with that, members, we stand adjourned. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone.